You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After Bill Clinton was elected, he called the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch with a suggestion that they meet periodically during the time he spent in the White House so that he could provide a contemporaneous account of his presidency. Taylor Branch was on our show in September to discuss the book that resulted from those discussions, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, and listeners told us that they enjoyed our conversation, so we thought we would play it again for you on this long holiday weekend. I began by asking Taylor Branch, why did President Clinton want to tape those conversations? Why did he want what he called his own Arthur Schlesinger?
Well, that was his first proposal. He was concerned that a really living and dynamic record be preserved of what happened. And this is before he was took office. This is when he was president-elect. And his first idea was an Arthur Schlesinger-type person in the White House, which I advised him against, and I certainly didn't want to be myself. I was working on my Martin Luther King era work. But he said that he had read the footnotes in my King books and saw that so much of it came out of the Kennedy, Johnson, and Eisenhower libraries. And he said, I want historians to be able to do that 50 years from now, but I'm worried that the records are going to be too distant. And anyway, this oral history was the best thing we could devise.
And it was an attempt to demystify the presidency?
Make it real. He knew how much I valued, because I said in the books, the tapes of Lyndon Johnson's phone conversations about Vietnam as something that will one day, when we're a mature country, inform our decision and understanding about that war. But until then, we only had images and things that were filtered of him as a warmonger or this, that, and the other. And he was afraid that the same thing would happen, and unfortunately, he has been trapped a lot in images.
In those Johnson tapes, we even hear him calling a tailor to order trousers. So
yes,
we do have a real sense of who Johnson is. But you didn't have the tapes when you were writing the book. Why not?
Well, this whole project was designed so that he could have control of them and that he could decide when they'll be placed in the public record. Every time I did a tape with him, I had my two recorders. I would record him talking to me, usually late at night in the White House, finish, give them to him so that he could hide them. I didn't even know where they were hidden until late in his presidency, when he started asking me to put them away. And then I would leave the White House, put a new tape into the tape recorder. I had to drive home to Baltimore, and I would immediately dictate everything I could remember that happened all the way home.
But obviously, if you'd had the tapes, you wouldn't have been writing under the kind of handicap you had.
Yes, but if I had had to advise him about opening the tapes and when to open the tapes, I would never advise him to give just me access. I would have to advise him to open them all, and I knew he didn't want to do that, at least until Hillary retires.
How many conversations did you have over his 8 years in office?
We had 79 full sessions of 1 to 3 hours. We had several others that were aborted or didn't count for one reason or another. They were interrupted, but there were 79 full ones.
And how often would you meet? How much advance notice would you get?
Often, you know, a couple of hours, because a lot of times it was when he had a cancellation. He was scheduled into the night almost every night, and I would get a call at 5 o'clock, the president's had a cancellation, can you come down tonight and have a session? And I would throw together my materials and drive down to Washington and get cleared into the White House, which was quite an adventure.
And who set the agenda on what to talk about?
I did. That was my job.
There questions that you felt you shouldn't ask?
Not really. I felt that my job, Leonard, in the sense that I didn't want to ask a question that was going to undermine his confidence in doing this process. My rapport with him was crucial to getting his candid disclosure of things that he hadn't otherwise put on the record.
And were there ever times when you felt he might want to end the project?
Yes. In fact, there was one time when I offered to resign because I was fearful that our secret was going to come out, and that I knew it wasn't me, but somehow it came out, and I said, I will volunteer to step aside anytime you lose confidence in me. And I thought he was going to say, no, Taylor, I know you didn't do it. And instead, he just looked at me and he said, that's understood. That if I don't want you to keep going on this, then that's over.
So in theory, nobody else knew that you were doing this.
In theory, and of course, the news never did leak. It was only his staff, because we were doing this at night, away from the West Wing, away from most of his staff. But still, to get into the White House, there are people around, and you always run the risk that somebody's going to say, what the heck is that guy doing here, or what's in his briefcase? And there were recorders.
Oh, I thought you'd say, I'm bringing a bottle of wine. I'm a drinking buddy. The way you write about them, the conversations seem to be wide-ranging, shifting from American electoral politics to Iran in the blink of an eye. Does that reflect how the conversations were?
Yes, yes. He would range over a wide range of topics. Sometimes he would just say there's nothing. I would ask him about Boris Yeltsin's last visit or his conversation with the Pope or what's going on with Newt Gingrich, and he would say there's nothing really significantly different than what's in the public record. Other times he would say, you didn't even ask me about this, but this happened. That's how, for example, at the end of his presidency, he told me Al Gore just came in. It wasn't on the record, but we had a Donnybrook for 2 hours about who was responsible for losing the 2000 election, and I want to tell you what happened. So sometimes he would put things on the record that I didn't even know about. I didn't even know to ask about.
There was that other contretemps with Al Gore over whether he was to stay in Washington and help Chelsea with her homework or go off and take care of some presidential business.
Almost. During the shutdown of government, Clinton canceled a trip to Japan for an economic summit and sent Gore, and Gore came back saying, you've insulted all of these countries because their leaders showed up, and they've all got problems too. And they said, where's Clinton? And you've got to go over there and mend this. And Clinton said, Al, I'm not going to go because this is Chelsea's midterm exams of her junior year, which are the most important tests in high school, and Hillary would have to go with me to Japan, and I'm not going to do it. And he and Gore had a ferocious argument over that.
The exchange between Al Gore and Bill Clinton about the 2000 campaign is very revealing about both of them. Did they have an uncomfortable relationship?
No, I think if you take their relationship over the full course of the book, which is quite interesting, there are times when their collaboration is very close, and he admired Gore. He said he would have made many, many more mistakes than he did, which he acknowledged were many early in the administration if it weren't for Gore. And Gore had a great sense of humor, and there were times when I saw Gore during our sessions, and they were funny. But then there were occasional conflicts, including over the election in 2000.
Taylor Branch is my guest. His book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, is published by Simon & Schuster. Well, many people feel Al Gore made a terrible mistake, not relying more on Bill Clinton. But I guess Gore, and I've asked Al Gore about that, and Gore right now kind of concedes that it was a mistake. At the time, I guess he felt he'd be tainted by Monica Lewinsky.
And he had many advisors who were telling them that, and that was their job. They saw themselves as trying to protect Gore. I think if you read the passage in the book in which Clinton describes this tempest, it is representative in the sense that he gives a pretty good sense of Gore's side of the argument too. He doesn't just selfishly gloss over Gore's objections and put only his. Clinton is pretty fair when he's recounting political arguments.
Did you get a sense that he could put himself in the shoes of other people?
Absolutely, particularly politicians. He never begrudged an opposing politician, Bob Dole or Newt Gingrich or any of them, the right to be nasty to him if it was in the pursuit of survival or votes. He was the same with Boris Yeltsin and foreign leaders. He knew they had to do and respected what they had to do to stay in power. He was more baffled about the American political culture and the media that would prefer to do tabloid things and silly stories and scandals rather than the great business before the country. And that disillusioned him because he had so admired the press.
Well, who brought those things up? Did you say, we have to talk about Monica Lewinsky, we have to talk about Whitewater, we have to talk about Vince Foster's death or Paula Jones? He, these are all things that plagued him over the course of his presidency. Was he totally open about them with you?
Some things he fussed about. Vince Foster, you mentioned, his dear friend who committed suicide, and yet the media and the right wing egged on conspiracy theories that the Clintons murdered him, and that went on for years. And he didn't need much encouragement to talk about that. He would just say, why would sane people do this, and what about them makes them want to do that, rather than talk about peace in the Middle East or ending the deficit. Our culture is cynical.
And he says that all of that talk took all the fun out of the presidency. He thought the presidency should be fun?
There were times when he said that, when he said, I'm bitter, I can't hide it, I'm bitter. But then he would also just endlessly theorize about why it was happening. Bill Clinton is a cerebral puzzle solver, and he thinks that his gift is his ability to marry rational analysis with personal interactions, that he can make contacts with people. And he got very frustrated that he couldn't solve that problem in American political cultures with the media.
A puzzle solver also because he liked to do crossword puzzles.
Oh, and a multitasker. I have one scene in the book where we're having a session. We're talking about every subject under the sun.
Airstrikes in Bosnia, if I remember correctly.
Warren Christopher calls to talk about airstrikes in Bosnia, and he's holding the phone, talking to me about our session, talking to Christopher about airstrikes, and he's doing a crossword puzzle at the same time and chewing a cigar. And he finished the crossword puzzle, and I guess he was bored. He was only doing four things instead of five. He started dealing solitaire at the same time, and he keeps up all of this at once. And that was noticeable enough that I put it in my notes and tried to describe that in the book.
Did he do that regularly? Because in the end, multitaskers don't do anything particularly well.
Mm-hmm. Well, he multitasked a lot, and he did seem to have something always in his mind, and you could see the stress of the presidency on him. Sometimes he would be talking with his eyes rolled back under the eyelids. He was so tired. And I would say, Mr. President, you all right? And he would just, like, snap out and keep talking.
Some critics have noted that he has a capacity for self-pity. Did you see that in your conversations with him? I'm thinking back to the taking the fun out of the presidency, but you write, he said the whole thing was stacked against him. It was not enough to do his job after all, nor was it an accident that these persecutions had reared up just in time to spoil his hard-won political gains. He sounds like he felt underappreciated.
At one point, he actually said, I gave in to self-pity. He said that was his signal weakness. He knew it enough to combat it, but he also knew that he gave in to it.
But didn't he also take responsibility for some of the things he did that would have caused any president problems? I mean, Monica Lewinsky, Paula Jones, those sorts of things, unless you're JFK in an earlier era, there's no president who could get away with that.
Right. Well, of course, Paula Jones he didn't do when he was president. That was something that trailed after him. I don't know that that had anything to do with this. But Monica Lewinsky, you're absolutely right. And in fact, one of the more emotional conversations we had about Monica Lewinsky, he used self-pity there. He said, I was feeling sorry for myself and underappreciated, and my discipline and resolve cracked. That's not a full explanation. And he said there wasn't one, and there were no excuses. But he said that was one time when he gave in to self-pity.
My guest is Taylor Branch, the best-selling author of Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954-1963, which won the Pulitzer Prize. Also, Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 63-65, and At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 65-68. He has written a book called The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, published by Simon & Schuster, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later in the show, a look at the retrospective of the work of Vasily Kandinsky at the Guggenheim Museum. Plus, Madeleine Albright explains how the pins and brooches she wore became a part of her diplomatic message when she was Secretary of State. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
We're back with an interview I did in September with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch. He was a guest on our show to discuss his book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, and we're rebroadcasting that for you now. I asked him about a story from his book that had made headlines about when the Secret Service found Russian President Boris Yeltsin in his underwear trying to hail a cab on Pennsylvania Avenue so that he could get some pizza. I asked Taylor Branch, couldn't President Yeltsin just have called the nearest pizza parlor?
Well, I guess he could have. I don't know why he did it. He was drunk. He wasn't making good judgments. Maybe people, he feared that his assistants would have said, you know, you should be in bed, Mr. President.
So was his alcoholism a more serious problem than most people believe?
That's actually how this came up. President Clinton didn't tell me this during our sessions just to have fun about the pizza. He said the alcoholism was a more serious problem than just Boris the Jolly Russian, that he had all kinds of problems dealing with Yeltsin, and that Yeltsin himself had all kinds of problems in holding the Soviet Union together, Russia together after the collapse of the Soviet Union. This is a serious problem that went all the way through. So the pizza story is a light moment in a very serious story full of personality.
Because Yeltsin was the transition leader, and that's a rough time for anybody, and here's this guy who could go off on serious drunks.
And his country's being taken over by the mafia and taken apart and building markets and new free institutions is not easy.
And obviously he wanted to be free of some of the constraints because the next night he got around security again, didn't he?
Actually, President Clinton, this hadn't gotten as much attention in the news media. You're the first person that's asked me about it. He said the second night was the more worrisome to him because the second night Yeltsin sneaked away again in Blair House, went down through the basement trying to sneak out with his clothes on this time, but was drunk and was accosted by Secret Service agents. And then Russian agents came behind looking for Yeltsin and accosted the Secret Service agents, and they weren't sure who each other were.
World War III could have broken out.
So we could have had a terrible incident down there. And he said that was a really dangerous security breach, but it was all stemmed from Yeltsin's drinking.
In his first term, President Clinton tried to tackle health care reform. What did he say about that effort?
Well, he said a lot of things. I mean, about the strategy and about the timing. In the end, in a postmortem, he said, I probably should have tried to do small piecemeal health care reform rather than a great big comprehensive one. At another time, he said, I shouldn't have done it so soon after the Budget Reconciliation Act because it allowed the Republicans to say I was just a big government takeover artist and a tax person.
Well, do you speak to him today? Because Barack Obama's hearing similar arguments.
Similar arguments today. A lot of these things from terrorism to health care are as much about the present as they are about the past.
Although at that time the insurance companies were running ads in opposition, nowadays it's become a purely political problem.
Yes,
for
and
the
in
president.
Those and in those days the doctors were against health care reform. Now the doctors are for health care reform because they feel victimized by the health insurance companies too.
You said it was too complicated, and that was a criticism. Some people said he shouldn't have given Hillary Clinton and Ira Magaziner the job because they came back with too complicated a plan.
Yes, he discussed that a little bit, of course, but he's very protective of Hillary, and he thought Hillary did a magnificent job trying to sell something that was undermined by a mountain of money, and he only really discussed his own mistakes, mainly that he said in a way he should have waited for a longer period to see that the Budget Act worked and was creating jobs and that it was not wrecking the economy, as the Republicans said, and then tried. But he felt that he had to push health care reform through too soon, and it didn't work.
And this is a thing that politicians often do when they think they're really popular. The same sort of thing happened with Barack Obama, and it seems to have backfired for him as well.
Yeah.
What was the situation different in the project during the second term? Because he now could become more candid, couldn't he? He didn't have to worry about re-election.
He didn't have to worry about re-election. He did have to worry about scandal, and a sense of fatalism set in fairly early that a really ambitious agenda was not going to be possible. You'll see a theme in there where he's saying, I'm going to have to do things piecemeal and keep working at them and ignore the scandal and the scandal mongering and rise above it and just get up and come to work every day. And he started fussing less about the press and saying, I'm going to do small things piecemeal.
Well, a lot of people talked about his charisma and how when you met him, he looked you in the eye and you felt like you had a real connection. He remembered people. Did he talk much about the qualities that a president needs to be an effective
leader? Oh, absolutely. I think I mentioned that there was China's president, Jiang Zemin, for example, he said was the one foreign leader where he could not make any personal connection with him, and he said that was one of his biggest failures in foreign policy. And he said it with a sense of disappointment because he thought that if he had a gift, that was what it was to make personal connections with all kind of people, and he couldn't do it with him. Another time, on a different matter, he said, I may not be a good enough actor to be president. I welcome reasoning together and talking, and maybe the more effective presidents are the ones who conceal all of that indecision and talking and just come out on high on horseback and announce a decision and try to intimidate people.
He was thinking of Ronald Reagan, I assume.
Yes, I don't intimidate people, and maybe I should have worked on that more. I'm not a good enough actor.
Well, you get the feeling that he really is such a political animal that he knows pretty much everything that happens in politics. And you talk about his impressions of the 2000 campaign.
Mm-hmm.
He obviously didn't think Al Gore ran it very well.
No, he didn't. And early in the campaign, but he would handicap people from the very beginning when the very first primaries occurred. He said, now on the Republican side, it looks like it's going to be McCain or George Bush Jr. I've had them both here in the White House, and my impression is that they're mirror images, that Bush is very shrewd about how to run but would be unqualified to be president. McCain might make a good president if he could get elected, but he has no idea how to run. So that one is a statesman but not a politician, and the other is reverse. And he's saying that sort of thing in maybe January 2000, the date's in the book.
He predicted that the Supreme Court would help Bush in the recount if it got the chance. Were you surprised by how right he was so often?
Yes, he wasn't always right, but he was right and raw about a lot of things that had to do with politics. He also said, for example, that when he was worried about the Chinagate scandal and Wen Ho Lee, the Chinese scientist who was unfairly accused of stealing secrets and Clinton was caught up in that, that in the course of that he found out that we were detaining and holding people for years without any charges in his administration, which predates 9/11 and Guantanamo. So he said some pretty raw and surprising things to me about what was going on inside his administration.
He also thought that Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski would have made an ideal running mate for Al Gore. Did anybody else go along with that?
Not a soul. I don't know whether he told Gore about it or not, but he had been talking regularly about Barbara Mikulski because he said she had a gift for connecting, for cutting through all the palaver about politics and connecting with real people. Why you have a stake in this decision. You're the citizens. You own this government. This is important.
So he saw in her things that he valued in himself.
Absolutely, and thought that she would make a wonderful counterpart, kind of a folk hero. She's only 4'11", and she has this amazing beer hall voice, and that she would be great. And then he told this wonderful story of how in one of her campaigns she'd been confronted with rumors circulating by her opponent that she was a lesbian, and she went and gave a speech. She convened a speech to all the people she had grown up with in Maryland who were the business leaders and said, I hear what's going around. I'm your maiden aunt. There's one of me in every family. And if it bothers you, I've only one question. Where were you when I needed a date to the prom? And Clinton loved that story because he said in 30 seconds, without saying a harsh word, she disarmed her of all her opposition. He said that's the kind of communication Al Gore could use in this campaign.
Clinton, on the correct side, thought that George W. Bush might want to go after leaders like Saddam Hussein. How did he come up with that?
Well, he had briefings George W. Bush was pronounced the new president-elect by the Supreme Court. Clinton gave him briefings on a lot of subjects, and they talked about North Korea, and they talked about Iraq. And in our last session up at Chappaqua, he said he was very disappointed that George Bush had already thumbed his nose at two of Clinton's farewell recommendations, keep paying down the deficit and the national debt, and keep involved in the peace processes around the world, because Bush threw out South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and said negotiations with North Korea are worthless. And he said to me, he said, for my briefings with George Bush, his idea of leadership is leading a charge against a bad guy, not trying to put together new coalitions to address international problems like the Middle East or Bosnia. And he said, I know for a fact he wants to go after Saddam Hussein.
My guest is Taylor Brandt, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of America in the King Years. His latest book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President. It is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why wrestling history?
Well, a lot of this is fussing about a lot of these conversations are fussing about what our history means for American politics. I think it's still true. A lot of our politics today is, what does our history tell us about whether government is a good force or a bad force and can be a noble profession or a bad one? Clinton repeatedly said that his mission was to try to lay the groundwork to rescue American culture from cynicism that he felt had set in from our youth in the civil rights era, that because we knew that government and politics had really worked miracles that changed the everyday life, not just of black people, but of white Southerners for the better. You know, the South was the poorest region in the country when it was segregated, and then all of a sudden it turned into the Sun Belt. This is a positive result from government, and yet the overriding image that we've had since then is that government is bad and it's a plague and a scourge. And he was trying to rescue the nobility of politics. He loved politics.
Well, what happens with a president like Bill Clinton, or any president, is that if you're an admirer, you go down a list of positive things. If you're a critic, you go down the negative things. Mm-hmm. And he had an awful lot of negative things to deal with, some of them from people who would be his friends. For example, Rwanda. Mm-hmm. What did he tell you about Rwanda and why he didn't act in a way that many people felt he should have?
We talked about Rwanda not a lot, in part because we missed it as it was going by. At the very beginning, he was not as defensive as he was about it later. He said
800,000 to a million people died and nobody made a peep.
But he said what happened in Rwanda was not on CNN, so nobody cared, not just in the United States, but they didn't care about it in anywhere around the world. Plus, it happened pretty quickly, so it would have the kind of military intervention that people hypothesized might have worked would have been almost impossible to do. Nevertheless, he felt bad about it in retrospect, but at the time, in the book, the things that he said in our sessions were not as defensive as he became later.
At the end of his presidency, his wife was already running for the Senate here in New York. What did he say about that race?
Oh, talked about it a lot. In fact, once Hillary walked in on one of our sessions and said to me point blank, Taylor, do you think I should run for the Senate in New York in 1999? And I'm there supposed to be asking Clinton questions, but I'm kind of put on the spot, and he's looking at me wondering what I would say. And from then on, he talked about her races, what it was like for her to become a candidate as opposed to a confidant, how hard it was for her to learn the culture in New York, and how proud he was that she did and that she got over her the bruises that you get. She said New York's a rough place to campaign in, but if you win, it's loyal. And it's Bobby Kennedy's seat that he held in the Senate, and that Hillary would have a wonderful position from which to be a public servant.
He was on Meet the Press last week, and he said that he still believed that the vast right-wing conspiracy that Hillary claimed was happening 10 years ago was alive.
Well, certainly the people that are out promoting the shouting matches at healthcare seminars and Obama is Hitler and Obama is a socialist kind of thing. Those people are quite fearful of the modern world, and they're not above promoting any kind of conspiracy theory that will derail Obama's political agenda.
But what Hillary was talking about was a conspiracy run by a few very wealthy right-wingers, people like Scaife. Do you think that's true, that there are a couple of multi-billionaires out there who are manipulating some gullible American citizens? Many people objected to that.
They objected to the phrase, which is overly mechanical. It makes the world sound like the Wizard of Oz. The world's not the Wizard of Oz. There's not that much there. But there were people. There was a lot of the Clinton presidency was a struggle to explain why the media agenda of Whitewater, Travelgate, Filegate, Vince Foster was so congruent with the Republican agenda, which is this president is not qualified to be president. And a conspiracy is an overstated and dangerous and ultimately backfiring explanation. But there was a lot to it. They didn't quite understand why it was happening.
President Clinton published his memoir, My Life, in 2004. Did you have a sense that he was drawing upon the tapes that you'd made together?
Well, that's one of our not that many points of overt conflict and difficulty in the book, because when I went up to read the manuscript, he invited me in late February of 2004. The manuscript had just completed his pre-presidency, and the book was published in June. So he had just a couple of months to write the entire presidency, and I said, this cannot be. You may use the tapes, but only to skim through them very rapidly. You can't write 8 years of the struggle that we have described all through these tapes in 2 months. It's not responsible. You need to either have two volumes or get a delay. And he said he couldn't do it, and we had a big argument there. And even in retrospect, I'm not sure whether or not the subtext was that I would have a chance to begin the wrestling with these tapes in my manuscript, and that he wasn't going to do it, but for one reason or another. And I still, to this day, don't know why he didn't make more time to readdress all of those issues.
What about this book? Has he seen it?
I took it to him in Chappaqua, yes.
And did he say, Taylor, this is great. This is exactly what happened.
Well, I probably shouldn't get into his reactions. We've talked four times or more for hours since. A lot of his typical Bill Clinton, you could have emphasized this a little more in the next edition. You can do that more, and I might have saved you this error. And did you have to do that? And I didn't change any of the cosmetic. Did you have to do that? But sometimes he actually did correct an error or two. I referred to Jiang Zemin as the premier of China, and he says, you got that wrong. He was the president. He won't like it. His reaction is complex, but he's always worried that anything this personal will be distorted to undermine the substance of what he's trying to say. And I'm hoping that the personal will reinforce the political message rather than overwhelm it.
Taylor Branch's book, The Clinton Tapes, Wrestling History with the President, is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Leonard. Great to be here.
Up next, curators Tracy Bashkoff and Carol Vail describe the retrospective of Vasily Kandinsky at the Guggenheim Museum and the relationship the work of the abstract artist has had with that institution. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.